This is Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. This hour, Hurricane Ida was the biggest storm to hit New Orleans since Katrina, but the levees held this time. Why? Also, how researchers genetically engineered mosquitoes so that those mosquitoes are unable to see humans. And we'll chat with the lead singer of Tank and the Bangas, which got nationally famous after winning NPR's Tiny Desk Contest. That's coming up on Top of Mind. It's good to have you with us. Much of New Orleans remains without power since Hurricane Ida hit on Sunday, which was also ominously the anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. But unlike that disaster 16 years ago, Ida's storm surge did not breach the levees that protect New Orleans. What lessons did Katrina offer in preparation for Ida? And what lessons do we take from Ida moving forward? Sandy Rosenthal is a resident of New Orleans. She's a citizen activist who founded levees.org after Katrina to push for accountability and improvement of the city's storm defenses. She's author of Words Whispered in Water, Why the Levees Broke in Hurricane Katrina. And she's with us now. Sandy, hello. Thanks for your time.
Thanks so much for inviting me.
How are you? You evacuated before the storm, I take it. That's why we're able to talk, because you have electricity where you are.
You know, that is the big issue. That was an infrastructure issue that was the problem with Hurricane Ida, and that is electricity. And that is really the only reason that I left New Orleans a day before the storm. I was not concerned about flooding or wind. I was most concerned about completely dependable internet. Mm. And that's the reason that I evacuated.
Yeah. And also water. I should have mentioned a lot of New Orleans is without safe water or water pressure to be able to flush toilets, and certainly not drinkable water. So they're under a boil alert, which is kind of standard stuff. Is what New Orleans is experiencing right now pretty standard in the wake of a hurricane?
Well, it's important to note that this wind event was not as bad as Hurricane Katrina was. Hurricane mm-hmm. Katrina was actually more of a wind event, and we didn't lose power like this. Mm-hmm. It's a very different storm. The storm surge was different. The direction was different. Everything is different about this storm, and we'll talk about that a lot more in the next few minutes, about why the levees held this time and didn't last time.
Yeah, so you say you weren't worried about flooding, though, which is, of course, what the real disaster was for Katrina, when the levees just didn't hold up. And so much of the city flooded. Why were you so confident that flooding wasn't going to be a problem this time around?
Well, first of all, that's not true about Hurricane Katrina. We weren't worried about the levees breaking. If you recall, 100,000 people were in the city when the levees broke. So nobody anticipated anything like what would happen. Mm. We thought we were protected by levees built by the federal government. And of course, we all know what happened. We now know that the Army Corps' levees failed. They didn't perform as designed. That was 16 years ago. Since then, the Congress gave the Army Corps $14 billion and said, okay, this time build it right. And this time they did build the system that we should have had 16 years ago. So when I saw the path that Ida was taking and saw that it was coming from the west, I would have stayed had it not been for my concern about internet. My son stayed in my home. I had no concerns for my son. I was not worried about him. And the city did not order a mandatory evacuation because we have a completely different flood protection system today. Mm. But on the other hand, what concerns me is there has been very little talk about why the levees broke 16 years ago. And that is because the Army Corps of Engineers did a faulty design. The levees were not properly designed. And that's why they broke. It's not because Hurricane Katrina was a particularly large storm. It was not in the city of New Orleans.
What was faulty about that original design, which has since been fixed with Katrina?
In the main basin of the city, which has the most people, property, and infrastructure, that's where I live, that's where the Superdome is, that's where Tulane and Loyola are. In the main basin of the city, the central portion, the reason that the levees broke was because the Army Corps made a design mistake. They were looking for ways to save money on steel and decided to use shorter sheet pilings. And that is why the levees broke during Katrina. Had those levees held, the main basin of the city would have had no flooding, and Hurricane Katrina would have been an entirely different event if not for that design flaw. And what concerns me is there's been very little talk about the Army Corps' mistakes 15 years ago. Yes, the levees held 3 days ago. Yes, they held this year, but at enormous and horrific human cost. More than 1,500 people passed away.
Right, after Hurricane Katrina and that flooding.
Yes.
What is a levee exactly? What's a levee made of?
A levee is a structure. It is usually composed of earth, but often, as in the case of the levees in New Orleans, they're reinforced with steel and or concrete. To make them super strong. The Mississippi, the Missouri, the Ohio River, those are all flanked by levees to prevent water from going, you know, over the tops of the banks and flooding the nearby St. Louis or New Orleans. So a levee is a structure. It's a man-made structure. And these structures failed during Hurricane Katrina.
Because they weren't sufficiently reinforced?
That's correct.
Okay.
They weren't tall enough? The walls were built to a height of about 14 feet above the levees. You've got your earthen levee, and then you've got your steel sheet piling sticking out of them. Mm-hmm. And they were sticking out of a height of about 10 feet. Water was not at the top of those levees when they fell over on both sides. So in the case of Hurricane Katrina, the levees were improperly designed by the federal government. More than 1,500 people are dead. The same number of people died in the Titanic disaster, and we're still talking about that 100 years later. Mm. And I hope the same is said about the levee failures during Katrina.
So after Katrina, that's when you formed your organization, levees.org. How did you become an activist? When let's remind people, after in the months and even years, in the initial years after Katrina in 2005, the Army Corps of Engineers was not being specifically blamed for having built the levees incorrectly. There was talk about, you know, it was the locals' fault for having, you know, not wanted the design that the Army Corps of Engineers had put forward, or it was, you know, the locals' fault for staying when they should have left, or maybe we never should have built a city so close, you know, on below sea level. Like, there was a lot of blame going around, but not a lot of it was specifically looking at the engineering of the levees. Why did you start looking at that?
Yes, there was. You did a very good job explaining what was happening in the weeks and months and years after the levees broke. It took many years for all the studies to be complete and find out exactly why they fell over. We're talking about not just a disaster, a catastrophe. Mm-hmm. 53 different levees breached all over the city. It took years to nail down exactly what went wrong. In the meantime, the locals were blamed for not leaving. The locals were blamed for living there in the first place. You name it, locals were blamed, including me, for what happened to us, when the real culprit is the federal government. And by the way, the Army Corps spent millions and millions fooling Congress and the American public about their role in the flooding. So it's bad enough that the Army Corps levees broke, but they tried to cover up that mistake. And if it weren't for the work of my group and thousands of supporters nationwide, the Army Corps would have gotten away with it. Everyone would still think it was just a bad storm.
How can you describe how it was? And the allegations that you're making, you outline in your book, they've also been documented and backed up by reporting by the New York Times, for example, and in other reports that have since been done by engineers who were involved in assessing the levees. But how is it that what was it that the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers tried to do in the immediate aftermath of the levee failure?
In the immediate aftermath, the Army Corps of Engineers refused to answer any questions from Congress. They said, we're not answering any questions until the levee studies are done. Well, it took years for that to happen. And in the meantime, all the stories and all the myths and all the misinformation flew around the world at a time when the American people were paying attention. The whole world watched the city of New Orleans go underwater and watched for weeks, watched people on rooftops. So that is a big source of the problem. But it's not just that. The Army Corps of Engineers spent a lot of money harassing me and my group, or harassing anybody who tried to talk about a narrative different from what the Army Corps of Engineers was saying. And I could go into a lot of it right now, but all of that is in my book if anyone would like to see it.
What ultimately, though, led to the unmasking of the situation, to understand that the initial design had been faulty and the Army Corps of Engineers had made poor choices when they designed those levees?
That's a great question. And I would say the number one turnaround in the way the media talked about the levee breach event was probably an article that was released in 2015 in a journal called Water Policy. And this article, you know, it's entitled Why the Outfall Canals Broke During Hurricane Katrina. And in this article, which was featured in the New York Times, it explained, you know, in black and white, very clearly, you know, what happened during Katrina, who was at fault and who was not. And the authors of that paper, two of them at the University of California, Berkeley, and one formerly there and now at Missouri S&T, they are the authors of this paper. And it just spells out clearly that fault for the levee breaches during Hurricane Katrina lies only with the Federal Army Corps of Engineers, and not with the locals, not with the city's geography, and certainly not anything that the locals did or did not do.
And since then, the good news is that $15 billion federal dollars went into rebuilding the levees to a point now where what's different and what makes you so much more confident in them when a large storm approaches?
Certainly. Probably the number one reason that the city is safer now, so safe that I would have stayed, so safe that I allowed my son to stay, was the Army Corps of Engineers had built gates at the mouths of the drainage canals to prevent water from flowing into the heart of the city. That was what was supposed to have been done 16 years ago. It wasn't done, and that's what's built now.
Sorry,
and
so those, gates, yes. Gates that open in the event of a or that close, or why would a gate be helpful?
These are gates that are closed in advance of a hurricane storm surge.
Oh,
and
okay.
We did not have gates when Hurricane Katrina arrived 16 years ago.
So
and
the storm
Army Corps
surge
afterward, in an attempt to defend themselves, claimed, "Oh, we wanted to build gates," and there's a tiny shred of truth in that. That is true for two little small canals. They wanted to build gates, but here's the key. They wanted to build gates because they were cheaper, not because they were better. But for the main outfall canal of the city, the biggest and most important drainage canal in the entire city of New Orleans, the Army Corps of Engineers didn't want to put a gate. Mm. So the Army Corps tried anything it could to defend itself and almost got away with it.
And so the gate is normally open, but during a storm, it can close, which then can prevent a major artery where storm surge can flow into the city. Is that correct?
That's exactly correct.
Okay.
And we did not have that 16 years ago. We do have those now.
So in terms of living in New Orleans post-Katrina, hurricanes have happened periodically, nothing as dramatic as, Ida was as close as we'd seen to the scale of Katrina. But why do you stay? How comfortable can you feel living in New Orleans where you know that much of the city is below sea level and you are at the mercy of these man-made structures to protect you?
The main difference is sunlight is a wonderful disinfectant. The Army Corps of Engineers mistakes were made, put out there for the whole world to see. The Army Corps of Engineers doesn't want to have two failures under its watch in the exact same place. And the Army Corps of Engineers was handed pretty much all the money it needed. And this isn't my description. This is the description of the local levee boards. The Army Corps was handed pretty much all the money it needed to build the system that we have in New Orleans. And $14 billion will give you a good hurricane protection system. Mm. But what makes me bristle is the Army Corps of Engineers is being congratulated and given a slap on the back for 3 days ago for their system's performance, while people have seemed to have forgotten the 1,500 people who died 16 years ago, you know, and when we found out that their levee didn't work. And that irritates me a lot. If we don't teach our engineering students and our engineering professors, you know, why the levees broke 6 years ago, how can we expect condos to stop collapsing in Surfside, Florida? How can we stop? Why should we expect for the Hard Rock Cafe hotels to stop collapsing? What happened 16 years ago was engineering failure, American engineering failure. And so that has to change.
Sandy Rosenthal, are levees really a concern for anywhere except for New Orleans and a few of the other sort of coastal parts of the country that are prone to hurricane storms?
Well, there are levees in every state of the nation. And a whopping two-thirds of the American population lives in counties protected by levees. So, yes, anything that anybody should be concerned about levees and levee failure. But probably the state of the country with the most worries and concerns about levees is probably the state of California. There are more people in California at risk of levee failure and the danger of saltwater intrusion into their drinking water than Texas, Missouri, and Louisiana combined.
Where are the levees?
Every state of the nation has levees.
How would I know if I'm relying on a levee? You have to be near a body of water. Is it primarily ocean? Are we also talking about rivers?
After Hurricane Katrina, the Army Corps of Engineers created a levee database. Hmm. So you can go to this levee database at the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers website and type in your zip code and find out whether or not you are near a levee. But one thing positive I can say for the people of America, you know, at the expense of 1,500 lives 16 years ago, the people of America are safer because of what happened to us. The Army Corps of Engineers has changed the way they build levees. They've also changed the way they require levee inspections for all of their levees that they've built and turned over to local authorities. So there is a bright spot. But nonetheless, we cannot ever forget that what happened to the folks in New Orleans was levee design failure, not Mother Nature.
And so there's nothing to the argument that says storms are getting bigger. We couldn't have expected this.
Hurricane Ida was not as strong as Hurricane Betsy or Hurricane Camille. Or certainly Hurricane Katrina in Mississippi. Yes, I do see that there are more storms coming. There's no question about that. I do believe, and I have believed in global warming since 1985. There are more storms coming. So something can be said for the danger of storms, but we can't expect the people of New Orleans to up and leave because we have the fifth largest port in the world is right there at the port of New Orleans. And that's not going anywhere soon.
Is Katrina, the legacy of Katrina, still being felt in New Orleans today?
I would say yes. There are many people that, despite knowing that the levees are better and knowing that the Hurricane Ida took a different path, there are many people who are up and out, you know, days in advance. You know, that's something that we will never forget, you know, how vulnerable we are in the case of mass shutdown of the things we depend on, like electricity, like internet, like phone services. So yes, we will never forget. We will also never put total and 100% faith in our federal government or our local governments in New Orleans because of that feeling of vulnerability when a major event happens that was unanticipated. I don't think anyone anticipated that the Entergy, what I'm talking about at the power company in New Orleans, towers would all go down and leave us with totally without power in such a wide range. That was unprecedented. I don't know anyone that claimed they knew that was going to happen.
Is there a psychological toll, though, that because of the trauma of Katrina, makes this time of year, and especially when a storm hits on the anniversary, more difficult to kind of stomach.
I understand exactly what you're talking about. It's an angst. It's a nagging fear. I felt it myself. Should I go or should I stay? And I can tell you personally, even though I don't think I suffered something like something quite as dramatic as post-traumatic stress syndrome, I can tell you that after the levees broke 16 years ago, it took me months to be able to do something like sit down in front of a television set and watch a rerun of Seinfeld. I could not do something as simple and relaxing as that. I had to be constantly working, reading, writing, listening to the radio, trying to figure out what happened. And of course, now I'm glad I did, or I never would have formed the group levees.org or written a book or be talking to you today.
So the activism was actually a kind of coping with the trauma mechanism for you.
That's exactly correct. That was my way of coping.
Sandy Rosenthal is a citizen activist, founder of levees.org, and author of Words Whispered in Water, Why the Levees Broke in Hurricane Katrina. Sandy, I'm glad that you're safe and safely evacuated. Thank you for your time today.
You're so welcome. It was a delight to be here.
This is Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. Coming up in about 15 minutes, we'll chat with the lead singer of Tank and the Bangas, which got nationally famous after winning NPR's Tiny Desk contest. Just ahead, how researchers genetically engineered mosquitoes so that they cannot see people, can't see humans. Stay with us. Glad to have you with us today for Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. The deadliest animal on the planet is, can you guess? It's the mosquito. Diseases spread by mosquitoes kill and injure millions and millions of people around the world every year. We recently heard about an unusual line of research to tackle the mosquito problem. UC Santa Barbara neurobiologist Craig Montell is on a team that has genetically engineered mosquitoes so that those mosquitoes cannot see people. They can't see humans. Professor Montell is on the line. Welcome. Thanks for your time.
Yeah, happy to be here.
So how much do mosquitoes actually rely on vision, on sight to you know, make their way in the world?
Well, the mosquitoes that we're studying are called Aedes aegypti. They're the ones that spread the viruses that cause dengue and yellow fever, another virus, Zika, and they're most active during the day. And so they use lots of senses to home in on people, but vision is one of them. And once they detect the CO2 from our breath, vision and olfactory cues become very important.
Oh, okay. So they have the sense of smell and they have a sense of vision. Okay. So a mosquito are they using any other cues to sort of pick their prey?
Yes, absolutely. So at a distance, the visual cues and olfactory cues are very important. When I say a distance, it could be like from 30 feet away. And then when they get really close to us, they can detect the humidity from our skin. They can detect our skin temperature. And then there are other olfactory cues coming from our skin that may not travel as far, and they can only detect at close range. And then finally, when they land on our skin, then they're also tasting the chemicals on our skin. And that's like the last evaluation that they make to decide whether or not to bite.
So mosquito repellent is working based on you say olfactory cues. That's smell, right? So does it primarily work on the smell front when you cover yourself in off?
Yeah. So products like off are using DEET. DEET is the most commonly used insect repellent, and it works both through olfaction and taste. In fact, people for a long time thought it was just working as an olfactory repellent, but in fact, it's even more effective as a taste repellent or gustatory repellent.
And you said that they smell the carbon dioxide that a person exhales at it from a distance of like 30 feet.
Yes. So when we exhale, That increases the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere by 50-fold. Normally, it's very low, 0.1%, and that increases it to 5%. And that can actually travel as a plume for distances of 30, even 40 feet. But that's not a directional cue. When the mosquito picks up the CO2, that signals them to just become more active and start paying attention to, say, visual cues. Like, is there a person around that I can see? And also, olfactory cues. Do they smell the kind of scents that people put out that'll track them.
How good is their eyesight, though? They can't see from a distance all that well, but are they seeing, like, colors? Are they seeing, you know, just like shadows? What exactly are they seeing that they rely on as they get closer to a person?
Yeah, that's a good question. And it turns out that they're very, very light sensitive, but their visual acuity isn't very good. In fact, it's really not very good at all. And in fact, if there isn't a person around, they will, you know, use other features that they think even have a chance of being a person. And
they might like try to land on a chair or something, or try to feed off of some inanimate thing.
They'll approach it, but if they don't detect other cues associated with that, then they're not going to try to take a bite. One thing to point out, and it's good for your listeners to know, is that mosquitoes like Aedes aegypti are much more attracted to dark colors. So if you're wearing a black shirt or pants, that is going to make you more receptive. The mosquitoes can be more receptive to you than if you're wearing, say, a white shirt.
Interesting. Because they're so sensitive to light. And so they can maybe see dark colors more vividly.
Yes. Certain dark colors, especially the really dark ones like black, are very appealing to them.
Okay. And so you on your team have been working on disarming the visual cues, the visual ability of the mosquito. And so what exactly have you done to the mosquito?
Yes. So, you know, a few years ago, there was a revolutionary new technique called CRISPR-Cas9 that enabled labs like ours and others to go in and mutate genes at will, specific genes at will. And this has become very, very powerful. So it's only really in the last 6 or 7 years that's become possible to actually go in to a mosquito and pick out genes that you want to mutate. And so what we did is this. There are 10 members of a family of proteins that are light sensors. They're called rhodopsins. And we have members of this family in our eyes too, that allow us to see the features in our environment. And there are many of them. There are 10 in Aedes aegypti, 5 in their compound eye. And what we did was we mutated, using CRISPR-Cas9, the major rhodopsin in their eye. And it initially had no effect. We looked to see.
Meaning you like switched it off. So you went to one of these light sensing proteins in mosquitoes and you basically muted it for them.
Yeah, we deleted it.
Okay.
So using CRISPR-Cas9,
right,
it's basically like taking scissors and cutting it out,
right,
genetically.
Okay.
And
that had no real effect on the mosquito's ability to like find dark things.
Yeah, and the tests that we did, or the main tests that we did, is you can put these mosquitoes. Oh, and I should add, so folks should know this, is that it's the females that bite, and the reason that females bite is they need the blood for the blood for egg development. So if they don't. If it wasn't for the need of blood for egg development, they could do just fine on sugar from plants and so forth. Mm. But they go after us because they want our blood for egg development. And what we did was we knocked out or deleted the major light receptor or rhodopsins in their eye. And then we tested them in a wind tunnel. What we did was we shot CO2 at the same concentration that comes out of our mouths. And that caused them to become much more active. And then inside the wind tunnel at the source of the CO2, and it was a narrow plume, there was a dark feature and a white feature, a black feature and a white feature.
Like a cutout, a black cutout or a white cutout for them to see what they'd be attracted to.
They were even just circles. In an absence of a human, they'll even pick out a black circle over a white circle. Hmm. And the normal mosquitoes, the wild type mosquitoes, do that with great precision. And then when we knocked out the first opsin, they were just like the normal wild type mosquitoes. But then what we did is we knocked out a second opsin that was the one most related to the first rhodopsin that we knocked out. And then that single mutant, the opsin 2 mutant, also didn't disrupt their ability to find the black feature. But lo and behold, when we mutated both of them at the same time, opsin 1 and opsin 2, that absolutely eliminated their ability to find the dark feature. You could think of it as host seeking, that their ability to find the dark feature when they are stimulated with CO2, but they weren't blind. They can still move towards light. There were certain tests that we did. One's called an optomotor test, where you have alternating black and white stripes in a rotating drum, and a normal mosquito will walk in the same direction as the rotating stripes, and they could still do that. So they weren't blind, but they were blind to the visual feature that was sort of acting like the surrogate host.
Oh, okay. So if I'm a mosquito from 30 feet away, I'm a female mosquito looking for a host, an Aedes aegypti, and it's daylight or dawn or dusk, so there's enough light. The first thing that I'm looking for, I'm sensing the CO2, and I'm like, oop, human somewhere in the vicinity here, and then I move towards that using my visual cues, and then you're saying that when you knock out two of these light sensors in mosquitoes, they pick up the CO2, but then they just can't quite take the next step to figure out how to get close to the person. Like, they're having a hard time finding the dark shadow that would indicate a prey. Is that right?
Yes, precisely right.
But if they get close enough, won't their other senses kick in, and they'll like smell me or, you know, smell my pheromone, whatever it is that makes me smell attractive to a mosquito? You would think that they would at least kind of go towards the CO2 smell so that they could compensate for the lack of visual.
That's true. In this particular test, the only thing that was available to them was CO2 and the visual features. But in real life, if you had flies or mosquitoes that were blind, although they would be less effective at finding us, eventually they could still do it.
Okay.
Because they have other cues. They would have the olfactory cues. And then when they get really close, they could sense our skin temperature, the humidity come from our skin. Mm. But if the only thing available to them in this artificial test was the CO2 to activate them and the visual features, then they completely lose their ability to find the visual features, which is really acting like the surrogate host in this test.
Which is interesting, I guess, in terms of understanding how the vision of mosquitoes works. But this doesn't seem like a very useful way to try to go about preventing mosquito-borne illness by making mosquitoes blind. It seems like it would be more effective to make mosquitoes unable to smell, because then they wouldn't even be able to pick up the CO2 scent.
So it turns out that because they're using lots of senses to find us, you could eliminate any one single sense and they'll still find us. So if they're blind, although they won't be as effective, they can still do it. If they can't smell, they won't be as effective, but they have still the visual cues. They'll still have the ability to sense our temperature and humidity when they get close. So in order to really super effectively disrupt their ability to find hosts, one would have to simultaneously have mosquitoes that were disrupted in both their ability to sense CO2 and other olfactory cues and vision. Mm. Then they would be very messed up. Now, even though they could still then sense humidity and temperature from our skin, but they can only do that when they get close.
Right.
If you eliminate vision, CO2 sensation, and olfaction, they wouldn't be able to see us at a distance and probably wouldn't get close unless they just accidentally were next to us.
Will these people blind mosquitoes pass this genetic mutation down to their offspring? I mean, how do you, that seems like the only way, really, if you can release a whole bunch of them that you've genetically engineered and then just be sure that they're going to pass it on to their offspring. Otherwise, how do you even deploy this on a large scale?
So this particular research is not intended yet for deployment. It's really the first of its kind to show how not only how important vision is, but what are the light sensors that allow these mosquitoes to see hosts. And it's really further down the line that it might be effective to disrupt vision simultaneously with other cues like CO2 and other olfactory cues. And honestly, if mosquitoes couldn't find their hosts, what really would happen is the population would be suppressed because they couldn't get their blood meal.
Right. And then they couldn't lay eggs.
and they couldn't lay eggs. So really, so this research is the first of its kind to really identify the receptors of important vision. And but there are really other very different type of approaches that we and others are using for suppression strategies. And when you talk about suppression of mosquitoes, one thing I should point out, because some people, when they hear, well, if you're trying to get rid of mosquitoes, isn't that a bad thing? Because after all, you know, they're birds that eat them, they could be pollination vectors.
Yeah.
But Aedes aegypti, most places that they exist on this planet today, just a few years ago. They're invasive mosquitoes.
Professor Montel, we're out of time. Thank you for your time. Craig Montel is a professor of neurobiology at UC Santa Barbara. This is Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. This is Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. There is not a quirkier music venue out there than the Tiny Desk Concerts at NPR. Musicians literally stand behind the NPR music editor's desk and perform for a bunch of head-bobbing office workers.
It's missing something. It's missing you. Can I get a snap?
Some of the biggest names in music have done a Tiny Desk Concert at NPR, and they often quip about how it's the weirdest gig they've ever done. The weirdness, though, proved a perfect fit for the whimsical hip-hop soul and spoken word sound of Tank and the Bangas. In 2017, the group from New Orleans shot to fame nationally by winning the Tiny Desk Concert. This was their live set at the Tiny Desk after they won.
Man, you know I would have been the fish. I would have been the meat. I would have been the eggs, and I would have been the greens. Yeah.
This is lead singer Tariana Tank Ball. She got her start as a slam poet.
I would have been the fruit. I would have been the vegetables. And I would have been the soup. You know I wouldn't have been. Uh-huh. I couldn't have been.
Tariana Ball spent the pandemic publishing a book of her poetry and putting out a surprisingly upbeat EP with the band. She'll be at the Park City Song Summit the second week of September talking about her poetry and performing with Tank and the Bangas.
I would have been good for you.
Tariana Ball joins me now. Hi, thanks so much for taking time today.
Hey, thank you. I was bobbing my head like, yeah, that's me.
Is Tank a nickname that you use outside of the stage?
Yes, it's a family nickname, actually, that my dad gave me. It's so crazy that the whole world knows your family nickname. You know, nobody calls me by my name anymore.
It's just Tank. I mean, can you share why your dad gave you that name?
I have no idea. He died super early in my life, so I don't know why. I never. When I get to heaven, I'll ask him for sure.
Yeah. That's kind of sweet, though, to have that from him, to have his pet name for you.
Yes, it really is. I'm his little Tank Tank baby. He used to say his Tank Tank baby.
Oh, so tell our listeners a little bit about your origins. You started as a slam poet first. How did you get into slam poetry? What drew you to that?
I think that it started at my grandparents' 50th wedding anniversary when my cousin gave me a poem to do, and I messed up the poem so bad, even though I practiced it so much. But by the time I got on stage, I just messed it up so bad. I butchered it, and then, I don't know, but she saw something in me, so I was able to literally just go out and do this poem every time my grandfather would preach, and I would do this poem so I could just gain confidence in it. And it worked. It worked. And then in high school, just kind of being like really quiet and kind of a wallflower, there was a poetry slam at school. And I was like, I have to get in this poetry contest. And I did. And I was so scared to do these poems about other people that were really serious. But once I did it, the whole auditorium stood up for me. You know, like a girl they barely noticed in the hallways. And I just knew, I'm going to do this for the rest of my life.
Wow. You were a wallflower? That really surprises me.
Yeah, I didn't want nobody to. I mean, growing up in New Orleans public schools, you know, at times it's just not the easiest day. You know, sometimes you, there's always ribbing you talking about you, your clothes, your hair, your outfit, your shoes, all of it. So I would hope no one would notice me so that they wouldn't, you know, embarrass me in front of the classroom if I had on like old shoes or something.
So what was it about everybody seeing you on stage and appreciating you. It sounds like you got bit by something. What was it, do you think?
The attention bug? No. I think it was just the fact that that at that moment, it was just something in you to let you know that you had something that could shed a light on something that, you know, had no light on it at all, and that somebody felt how I felt, you know, and that I wasn't alone. Because if I was alone, then nobody would have clapped, nobody would have stood up. Someone, I resonated with some people in there, and I gave their feelings words, and that was a gift that I had. Everyone can't express how they feel. You think, oh, everybody can express how they feel, but they really can't. And I feel like I have the gift to give people's feelings words.
You said your grandfather was a preacher?
He was. Lots of preachers in the family. Mm. Lots.
So do you think that that oral, and was that an influence that also kind of underlies sort of how you perform, the ability to like move a room with words, you know, and keep people who are hot and tired in the pews engaged?
I think so, for sure. I think that the biggest part about it is that my grandfather was able to motivate people for the rest of their week for one Sunday. And I just kind of get to do it every day. And I get to take the church with me everywhere because it's just inside. So I get to motivate, encourage, inspire people wherever I go.
Yeah.
I don't have to keep it at church. And I think that's pretty cool.
What else from your upbringing can we see in your music? What other influences were really important to the sound that you and the group have created?
The Disney Channel. For sure. Like being so animated and so just this burst of energy. I mean, I just watched a lot of TV growing up. I was definitely that young girl in chat rooms that I shouldn't have been in, just chatting and having a good time. Mm-hmm. And just always watching TV, you know. When I was growing up, the internet was becoming a thing, and it was fun to explore and watch cable all the time, and Lizzie McGuire and One Saturday Morning with Pepper Ann, and It's Time for Animaniac. All of that stuff was Doug, everything. It was such a great childhood of television.
Oh, we can definitely see. I'm glad you mentioned that. I want people to hear a little bit of the performance you did for The Tonight Show with Jimmy Fallon, where people are going to hear this is a song called Nice Things. It was in 2019 off your album that had just come out at that point, Green Balloon. The voices and the noises, it's just so effervescent and fun. I want people to hear just a tiny bit.
You should do some nice things for me.
A little bit of Tank and the Bangas performing on The Tonight Show with Jimmy Fallon in 2019. So, Tank, you released this, your first...
So nervous.
You were nervous? God. I mean, that's a big deal.
Oh, my God. Tiny Desk and Jimmy Fallon was the most nervous moments of probably my career so far.
Yeah. I got to ask you, are you at all surprised that Tiny Desk, you know, that of all the places that would launch you to national fame and help you get a major record label, it was... NPR? Did that seem, was that even on your bingo card ever when you were thinking about how your career was going to play out?
No, not at all. Not at all. I wouldn't have even did Tiny Desk if it wasn't for my best friend who happens to be taking the Bangas manager, just kind of encouraging us for at least 2 years to do it. And we were so nonchalant. And so we used to be really, really big procrastinators. So she had to literally schedule it as if it was a show. We never miss a show. So she was like, yeah, you have to be at this place at this time. Da, 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 da. And we was like, okay, we got to be there now. Now we can't, you know, have no reasons why we can't. And it was literally the last day of submissions, and Bob Boylan, he just kept telling me that my life was going to change. I honestly didn't believe him, and I didn't know why he kept saying it, but he was right.
He's the host of All Songs Considered, the music editor that kind of got this whole thing going in your life. And it really did change things for you.
It really did. It really did. I can't lie. It did.
So, yeah, so that's 2017. Then you do your Tiny Desk concert, and then you, which, you know, goes viral. And then you get a major label, and you put out your album on a major label, and then the pandemic. Well, then you do Jimmy Fallon, and then the pandemic, and there's, like, no performing, and you're stuck at home. What was the last 18 months like for you as a performer who was just, like, on the verge, you know? Like, this was your big moment, and everything kind of froze up.
Well, I still feel like we took a lot of advantage of a lot of opportunities that were given to us. Because it wasn't just you signed a major label, you put out an album, pandemic hit. No, it was you signed a major thing. You go and you get Grammy nominated for Best New Artist, and you don't win that, but you still get the amazing opportunity to meet everybody there. And then the next day you fly to Japan, and then you come home, and then a pandemic hits, and then you still find time to create with your band during this pandemic, and you do a lot of Zooms for a lot of special people, and you still manage to create and do the first pull-up drive-up concerts in New Orleans. I'm not one of the people that's going to say that, you know, my pandemic was absolutely horrible, because it wasn't. It was a time to take a break and take a breather. Because right at the Tiny Desk, we toured a lot, and we were only home for like 3 days, you know, sometimes. And so I needed the break. I appreciated it.
That explains why the EP that you put out during 2020, Friend Goals, is so up. It's like really, I was kind of expecting, like, a lot of people's pandemic music is very sort of.
Oh, it's a Saturday. No, it wasn't.
In fact, one of your songs is about, it's a little, just hear just a tiny bit of it. It's called Self-Care. It's like a dance
tune.
I knew
you was going to play that. Well, I knew it.
It's just about finding the silver lining in solitude. Like, the video is all about, you know, all the things you can do for yourself. Meditate and yoga and take a bath. And here's just a tiny bit.
Nothing left but myself. Nobody else but myself. Nobody else but myself. There's no crew, it's me. Nobody else in the room. That's just how I do. Leave me alone.
Were you on your own during quarantine, or were you quarantined with your family? I know you've got some older sisters.
I quarantined with my best friend. That's why I quarantined. Well, we lived together at the time. So my quarantine was spent like, we cooked real food every day, something that we do not obviously do on a road. Rode our bikes through the French quarters at nighttime, which was, oh, it was like, it was just me in the city, and we were dating and falling in love with each other every night. I just spending that time alone, you know, not having a crazy schedule every day. A lot of artists did not like what was going on, because, you know, touring stopped and a lot of people were depressed. And I get that, because the beginning of my 2021 was a little scary, because, you know, 2021 had a couple of months left in the year. And I was like, oh, well, you know, hey, I guess I just get to chill. Then when 2021 hit and no gigs was there, you're like, hey, wait a minute. What's going on here? So I got a little scared in January. I really did. I did.
Well, tell me about the decision to, my understanding is, based on the information you put in this new book of poems you've published, that you had these poems, they had been written many years ago while you were in the depths of a relationship in which you were obsessively in love with someone who was not in love with you at the same intensity, and it
wait
didn't...
Wait a minute, Julie, wait a minute, you're not about to play me like this, wait a minute, I was not obsessively in love with this boy. I loved him, and it was a little infatuation involved, which is always there when you like somebody in a beginning relationship. It's so much freaking fun and explorative. Yeah. And he loved me too. Yeah. I just think that I was ready to be in a relationship before he was ready to be in a relationship.
Yeah.
That's what happened.
Thank you for clarifying that. What was
of course, this is me. I did.
What was the thinking behind putting that all out there to the world?
I have no idea why I decided to do it. I don't even have I just think it wasn't even a specific like aha moment. It was just, it's time to share. It's time to share. And, you know, and as long as I have his, you know, blessing to share it, then, you know, I'm cool with it. I do it.
I'd love it if you'd read the one Sun and Moon Folk, in which you talk about kind of the way that he mattered to you, and how that was, it was a little imbalanced and caused him to kind of pull back a little bit. I think we have a lot of us have experienced that.
Yes. I used to call you Sun, and I, your moon. We gave each other such important names so early in the day. Maybe I can see why you turned eclipse. Never thought that the names would become bigger than the sky that carried them. I guess you didn't want the responsibility of brightening my day in that way. I didn't know that you never wanted to gleam like that. But you should know, I didn't call you sun with the intent for such a responsibility. I called you sun because when I saw you, I shined.
What was it like going back through these poems years after, you know, you've moved on from that experience?
Like walking through a graveyard and a cemetery and a theme park all at the same time.
A theme park. I love that you referenced that because one of the songs I just love of yours is called Roller Coasters, and it's all about...
Oh, I thought you were going to say theme parks.
Oh, well, there is that one too, but this is one about like how being in love is like being on a roller coaster, and like why do people enjoy roller coasters and why can't we get enough? So if it's okay with you, I'd love to play that one to go out. Is that all right?
Yeah, sure.
It's the butterflies and the fireflies biting in my stomach.
Dariana Tank Ball is a poet. She's lead singer of Tank and the Bangas, and she'll be talking about her poetry and performing with her group at the Park City Song Summit September 8th through the 12th. Tank, thank you so much for taking time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Julie.
It's the way it jerks your neck, the way body has to reflex. The way stomach reacts, it's the thrill concept. It's a twist in the curve. It's the up in the swerve. It's the feeling of your nerves sitting on the front edge of their seats, front row, eyes open. Tears coming from the thrill of sight, moving as fast as light, laughing for no reason, screaming for everything you shouldn't have said in that fight. Roller coasters. It's like meeting God with a kite in your left hand, string still twisted around your forefinger, right hand still gripping the safety rail. There is this moment when you feel like you're in an ocean of your butterflies. This is the moment when you get free and you let your arms fly.
It's the firefly. And the butterflies biting in my stomach.
This is Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. This is Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. First, how chess became a powerful Cold War symbol. Then, the problem of super weeds. They're quickly becoming resistant to the most potent herbicides and could soon be causing massive crop losses in the United States every year. Also, Ken Rusk started off digging ditches, and now he's a proud blue-collar millionaire with a construction business empire. He's got a message for parents who might be panicked over a child who doesn't want to go to college. That's ahead on Top of Mind. Thanks for joining us. 49 years ago, this week, the American chess grandmaster Bobby Fischer beat defending champion Boris Spassky of the Soviet Union. It was the most publicized world champion chess match ever played, and Fischer was the first American to win the world championship in chess. The final game almost didn't happen, though. Fischer had already failed to show up for at least one game earlier in the match out of protest, and then this happened in the final match.
Well, Spassky is waiting.
Right, and it waiting and wondering whether Bobby will show or not show. And there's absolutely dead silence in the hall.
Spassky is pacing, he's nervous, and...
Wait, here comes Fischer coming on the stage saying that he was caught in traffic. And I think Spassky was visibly relieved.
And also perhaps pained.
Gotta love play-by-play chess commentary. So why was this one match such an international spectacle in 1972? Well, partly it's because chess is a game that is suited to epic storytelling, and partly because it was the Cold War, and anything pitting the U.S. and Russia against one another came with a lot of high-stakes emotion. Our resident storyteller Sam Payne joins me now to explore this a bit more. Sam is host of The Appleseed, a daily storytelling podcast produced by BYU Radio. Sam, welcome. It's good to see you.
Oh, it's great to be here. You know, I'm sitting over here as that clip was playing and my my knuckles are all white hanging onto the ends of my armrests here on the chair. It's high stakes stuff.
Oh, man.
This,
hey,
I guess I just should admit right from the outset that I have never learned how to play chess. Do you play chess? Are you a chess player?
I play chess a little bit. And chess has taken – you know, there was this kind of rite of passage, you know, in my young life when I graduated from Chutes and Ladders to chess. You know, my dad sat me down, taught me how all the pieces moved and things like that. I never did become very good, but I recognize kind of that moment again as kind of this rite of passage of sorts, you know.
Chess being a more sophisticated, also more like a serious person's game, but...
Yeah, at time honored, you know, this ancient game that people at some point learn how to play, unless you're Julie Rose.
Yeah. The rite of passage in my family was Scrabble.
Right, there it is.
Not chess. So I couldn't figure out how all the pieces move. Yeah. But tell me a little more about what you think is the appeal of chess, like... as a game that people play together, not at the championship level, say.
Well, you know, I've been thinking a lot about chess lately. My stepdad, since he was a little kid, he's got a best friend, his best friend Ernie, you know. And for years and years and years and years.
Is your stepdad's name Bert?
If only, right? Dennis.
So great. Yeah, okay. Dennis and Ernie. That's good enough.
And for years and years and years, kind of rain or shine, no matter where they've lived, they've always gotten together online and played a game of chess, you know, as long as there's been chess
like
online.
Like a weekly game of chess.
Yeah, weekly game of chess.
So cool.
And these are days when my stepdad is in this kind of significant sort of cognitive decline, you know. And it's been very meaningful for me to show up at his place and sit down and take out the chessboard and play a game of chess. That's one of the things that's keeping my stepdad and I connected, right? And it's really
he can still play. He can still remember how the pieces move.
Yeah. And you know, it's not to say much to say that he beats me in just about every game, right? But he does beat me in just about every game, you know. So I've been thinking about the role that chess plays not only in my own life, you know, and that rite of passage from Chutes and Ladders to chess, but also kind of the place that it has taken in the world story.
You know?
Chess, an ancient game. You know, you find chess pieces, those earliest chess pieces have all been discovered kind of along the Silk Road, those trade routes that connected eastern regions and western regions. And by the time chess came to Europe, right, it had become a game that was used to teach kids about strategy and about war, you know. It's how they learned about, you know, what it takes to get an army out onto the battlefield and where the strengths and weaknesses are in an army, and even some things about, you know, strategic sacrifice of certain pieces, you know, in favor of other pieces, and all with an aim toward winning the battle or winning the war.
Is not understanding chess or not knowing how to play it, are the rules really – is it a stretch to think of it as a military training exercise?
No, it is that nuanced, that flexible, that, you know, packed a game. All of that is there, you know. Anybody who's played chess for a long time will learn that it was used for that purpose and go, oh, yeah, I get it.
Hmm.
You know? The high and of course, there's the high competition, you know. I mean, I think there were like Saturday Night Live sketches sort of poking fun at chess clubs and things like that, you know.
Right.
But you get across the board from another player and suddenly you're kind of in this little mini battle.
Yeah.
And the stakes get pretty high. At the beginning of our conversation, I joked about sort of white knuckling the arms of my chair as I heard about, you know, Bobby Fischer and Boris Spassky. But it does get kind of like that.
Yeah. So if chess has often been a tool for training and or thinking about war, battle.
Yeah.
I guess it makes sense that people who weren't alive during the 60s and 70s and 80s, like there were a lot of really high stakes chess games going on. We don't hear so much about that very much anymore.
Yeah.
But this was a time when, like, you know, the Soviets had won the World Chess Championship for, like, they were the juggernaut and had won it since, like, the 1940s, you know.
They had sat in the champion chair for 25 years.
Yeah. And since the Cold War, of course, was not an explicit war of military aggression upon, you know, there was no battlefield.
That's
it was all about strategy and who had the nuclear, who was going to potentially launch a nuclear weapon and destroy the world.
Yeah. Lots and lots of high stakes emotions.
Yeah.
But few battles on the actual battlefield.
Right.
You know? And so we found opportunities, or people found opportunities, nations found opportunities to sort of play out some of the things that they might have played out on the battlefield in other arenas. Mm-hmm. You know, we talk a lot, for example, about the space race. You know, and that was a real sort of manifestation of a lot of those kind of battlefield impulses and sensibilities. But
The U.S. and the USSR.
Absolutely.
And, like, you know, they beat us to space, but we beat them to the moon, you know. And so it was a lot of national pride. But it was always kind of like, you know, our technical achievements were always sort of underlined by, well, did we beat the Russians or not? Like, is this a battlefield win for us?
Yeah.
In
my youth, we get stuff like Rocky IV, you know.
Okay.
Rocky Balboa and Ivan Drago in the ring together, you know.
Right.
But you had this real life contest where the stakes really were, for a lot of people, that high, this real sort of nations pitted against each other around the chessboard in 1972 with Bobby Fischer and Boris Spassky. You know, those games all took place in Iceland, and they took place over a long period of time. You know, those chess games.
It's like months and months. They had to play like dozens and dozens of games.
Yeah, a couple dozen games over about 6 weeks.
Gosh.
So you think about Bobby Fischer getting stuck in traffic, and you're like, yeah, it makes sense.
Last
game they played was the day before yesterday. But, you know, when that finally came to pass, and when Bobby Fischer was finally the champion, he came home to America celebrated very much like a war hero.
Really?
You know, he was on the cover of Sports Illustrated. he was, you know, there were like, you know, ticker tape parade. There was a Bobby Fischer day.
He did all the nights, an Olympian biting on his gold medal or whatever.
That's
like did the late night circuit.
He was on with Johnny Carson. He was on with Bob Hope, you know. And it really was this, we packed a lot of emotional energy into those games, you know, the same kind of emotional energy in some ways that we might have packed into a war.
Into an actual war.
Yeah.
And for you, it's no surprise at all that chess was the mechanism for that rather than Scrabble or tennis or basketball, you know?
Yeah, chess has been used to talk about those things for centuries upon centuries.
I mean, it was like layer upon layer that made it just exactly the right kind of like symbolic stand-in for Cold War aggression.
It's an ancient game, and it's been used often not only to talk about battle, but also the battles that that all of us face in our lives. One of the most famous paintings from, I'm going back now to like the 15th century, is a painting of death playing chess. Death as represented by this kind of skeletal sort of zombie looking guy playing chess opposite a human, you know. And one of them, there's a little banner above the painting that at one time, it's faded away now, but the painting at one time said, "I checkmate thee." So you got to believe that it's death saying it, right? But that idea of chess sort of containing in being sort of a microcosm of some of those big, you know, battles and struggles that we have in our lives, and we get ahead a little bit and we get behind a little bit. We have little victories and we have big victories, but the chess game goes on. You know, we've always thought of chess that way.
Yeah. Sam Payne, you always have the interesting story to tell, the backstory. Sam Payne is the host of The Appleseed, which is a storytelling podcast produced by BYU Radio. Speaking of, what's coming up on the podcast?
Listen, on Friday, we're going to play, it's a radio drama called The Shiny. It's about...
The Shining.
Not The Shining, right? It's The Shiny.
Ending in Y. Okay.
Ending in Y. And it's about a clan of talking flying squirrels in the San Fernando Zoo in an adventure in search of the shiny. Well, what's the shiny? Well, that's kind of the story. You'll have
to tune in. So it's like an old-fashioned radio drama.
Cooked it up right here in the Appleseed studio, and a lot of our BYU Radio family members are play roles in the thing. It's a real hoot, and we're really excited to bring it to the air.
Mm. You can look for the Appleseed wherever you get your podcast. Sam, it's great to talk to you. Thanks
for
your time.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Happy chess playing. This is Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. Coming up in about 15 minutes, Ken Rusk started off digging ditches, and now he's a proud blue-collar millionaire with a construction business empire. He's got a message for parents panicked about a child who doesn't want to go to college. Just ahead, the problem of super weeds. They're quickly becoming resistant to the most potent herbicides. Stay with us. This is Top of Mind. It's good to have you with us today. I'm Julie Rose. Just like the problem of bacteria developing resistance to antibiotics and becoming superbugs, there is an accelerating problem of super weeds in agriculture. Every season, farmers in the United States find their weed-killing chemicals work less well at controlling plants that choke out their crops. If herbicides were no longer effective, uncontrolled weeds could cause tens of billions of dollars of crop losses for American farmers each year. Is there a solution? Anita Dilley is a professor of weed ecology at Kansas State University working on this problem, and she's with us now. Professor Dilley, welcome.
Thank you.
Describe one of these weeds that farmers are having trouble controlling right now with herbicide.
Sure. One of the main weed species that many folks have heard of would be a plant called a Palmer amaranth or a pigweed.
Okay.
That may be known as a super weed.
What does it look like when it's growing?
When it's growing, it's one of the fastest growing plants that you may find in a field or in a garden just because of its ability to grow very tall, put lots of leaves on there. It's hard to say what it looks like. I thought most people knew what a pigweed might look like.
So does it flower? Does it have thistles or
puff? It's just the part that makes it such a super weed is that it just grows so fast. It's very large. It does not have really any prickles. It does not have any poisonous characteristics to it. Does not have very pretty flowers at all. It's just one of those big green weeds that you see growing in your field.
And why does it cause a problem for farmers when it grows unchecked?
You sort of described it earlier. It chokes out our crops because it grows so fast, and it does not have very showy flowers. So this plant invests everything into the seed, and these plants can produce hundreds of thousands of seeds. And so part of the problem, one plant by itself, not a problem, but with that many seeds being produced, then all of a sudden in a few years, you've just got so many new plants that are trying to come up every year. And so it just is so dense and they grow so fast and they're so competitive.
Faster than, say, like what kind of crops would be at particular risk of a Palmer amaranth like this?
Sure. So a lot of the main crops are those that we plant during the summer. So corn and soybean or other bean crops, grain sorghum would be examples of summer crops that this weed has the same life cycle and same time of emerging and growing with those crops.
But it just can grow so much faster than a soybean or a corn seedling that it'll overshade it. It can outcompete for space and water and other resources, I guess.
Yes, exactly. It's known to put an inch of growth on a day.
Oh,
and so that can be really fast.
Okay. And how have farmers traditionally controlled this weed? Because it's not a new weed to agriculture.
Correct. We've had it for a long time. It's been, it's sort of mainly in the southern part of the United States, but we see it creeping towards the north. And practices that we've typically used for weed control, of course, have been herbicides. In more distant past, a lot more tillage may have been done, some mechanical tools that prepare the field and would potentially have buried those seeds or limited their competition if that's what you use to control the weeds. But we've dominated a lot of our weed control with herbicide products along with, growing a competitive crop.
Specifically, what kind of herbicide? What is the chemical that's been most useful?
We have a wide range of different ones that you can put on. So some you can put on at the time of planting, so it goes on the soil and controls those little baby seedlings as they're trying to germinate and grow. And so we've had typical products that people may have heard, like atrazine in corn and grain sorghum, and other products that work on those little seedlings. And then we go, if those weeds have escaped or haven't had that kind of exposure to that soil herbicide, then we try products on the foliage, on the leaves. And then those are things like people have heard of glyphosate or Roundup products. They've heard of maybe things like 2,4-D or dicamba. These are what we would call growth regulator type herbicides. Mm. We've got others known as Cobra, Lactofen, or Blazer, and some of these are just, you know, they're contact herbicides. So if you get the product on the leaves, it'll burn those leaves off and control it that way. So we've had a number of different tools.
But I mean, with so many different tools, then why has a problem arisen here where farmers can't seem to find something that'll keep the Palmer amaranth in check?
So we've progressed because through time with certain products that work really well. So we use them, they work great, and then all of a sudden we find these plants that are resistant in that population. So the population we thought was susceptible, now I've got a few individuals now that have developed resistance. And one reason that Palmer is such a problem is that it is a unique plant because it produces male plants and female plants. They're completely separate genders, just like humans. And so to produce seed, they have to cross. They have to get pollen from somewhere else. Well, that just increases the amount of diversity, the different kind of seedlings that you might get. And through all those processes, you end up with, you know, a genetic change that says, hey, I don't need to be controlled by this herbicide anymore. And then by spraying all the others out and leaving that one behind, then that trait, that characteristic gets passed on to future generations, and then all of a sudden you get the problem.
Oh, so the genetic diversity of the unusual genetic diversity of this particular weed makes it so that it's more likely to randomly come up with a seedling that is unfazed by glyphosate or dicamba or Roundup or whatever.
Right. And so that's just how, and then we switch to a new product, and again, we have that random selection out there with that product, and we end up with another plant that may have that characteristic.
How fast does that process happen? Like, would it be in one cycle? One spray is going to be enough to sort of create a new population of resistant weeds?
It's like finding a needle in the haystack. If you can find that one plant that first season, you probably have it. But as a farmer, we don't realize maybe that we have lost weed control until we see that we've lost 20 or 30%. That there's 20 or 30% of those plants still left, even though I thought I was supposed to get 95% control. Hmm. I'm down to 70% or 60%. And then you realize, oh, this isn't working for me anymore, and potentially it's resistant. So then we do further tests to confirm it. But that's often, it takes a few years for someone to visualize it. But it can happen, you know, that selection process happens every time we use these different tools.
It only takes once. It just takes longer maybe to recognize that you have a wider spread problem. And why is this problem accelerating of super weeds?
That's a good question. In thinking about some of the technologies and the tools that we use for weed control, they are used on a tremendous number of acres. So instead of just one farmer, one field, and one place doing this, we see it spread across multiple states, multiple large acreages. And so all of a sudden, there's just so many of these events that are happening, and we just see it just progressing. So it's not as diverse in the range of tools that we use, but that we tend to use a few, and they're used on lots and lots of acres.
So American farmers in particular have become especially dependent on like the glyphosate or the Roundup or the dicamba. Is that fair to say?
It's tended to be that way. We've got the tools and the system works and it's cost effective, but then we realize that there's some of these implications of using that single system.
Because the more you expose a single population of weed to the same weed killer, the more quickly that resistance cycle can go.
Right. So then we call that selection pressure. So you're just putting pressure on that system and you eliminate the ones that, you know, will be controlled, and you just allow those resistant ones to keep
And can you explain for folks who are not in agriculture? I know this is a pretty well-known thing in agriculture, but can you explain why Roundup in particular has been so favored by farmers?
So we have used Roundup. It's been around since the late 70s as a very effective non-selective. So basically you can spray it on anything and it'll control them. And it's also very environmentally safe. It works on a system in the plants that's not in humans. And so that makes it safe when you're targeting what you want to control. So it used to be before a farmer would plant their field and they had weeds that they wanted to remove before planting, they could spray that field. Well, in the mid-90s, we then had that opportunity where we had crops that were now genetically changed to be resistant. So you could now plant the crop, spray this herbicide, and still control all the weeds. And so it was so cost-effective. It was one product. It was very environmentally safe. And so that really helped our farmers do a great job of weed control.
So farmers can buy corn or soy seeds that will grow plants that can survive being sprayed by Roundup.
Correct.
Okay. Which then became, so that would then encourage the farmer to kind of spray often and widely because they know their corn's not going to suffer. Right. And but the dark side of that is that it has served to kind of accelerate the selection of a super weed in the Palmer plants.
Right. And many and several other species of weeds. But Palmer just seems to be the one in the last few years since the mid-2000s that all of a sudden it's like, wow, this one is got some other characteristics that just really make it a problem.
Right.
But that's how, again, multiple acres, lots of acres with that trait and growers spraying these products, and it worked really well, and then the weeds just outsmarted us.
Yeah. And so trying to get ahead of the weeds could mean inventing a new herbicide, right, that the Palmer plants haven't developed a resistance to? I mean, is that a realistic option?
It's it's not a realistic option right now. We are not seeing the companies developing very many products, new products. We've got old ones. We're recycling and bringing those back in and developing systems where we can use, you know, previously discovered products. But it's a challenge to find any new products that we'd be able to use that work as well as, say, Roundup. So we really, as part of my research and teaching effort, really talk about what we call integrated weed management and really bringing in what are all the other tools than just herbicides to really be able to go after Palmer, because as we're describing these, you know, there's no pure definition of a superweed, but clearly Palmer is pretty close to what it might be, that we have to come up with alternative practices, strategies, things that we can go after it.
Speaking with Anita Dilley, who's a professor of weed ecology at Kansas State University, what else is there besides herbicide to control a weed like the Palmer amaranth?
We still want to keep herbicides in the program, but we can look at selective tillage if we needed to go in and do a little bit of tillage to knock those weeds out when they're little.
Let me just ask you though. Why tillage? Meaning you turn the soil. You go in and grind up the dirt. Why would that do anything to prevent those seeds from popping right back up again?
So you eliminate the newly germinated ones when they're little and knock them out, so that you've removed one set of the seeds out of the seed bank. And sometimes you have to do that multiple times, or you do it once. Get your crop established. So we talk a lot about how do I plant a really competitive crop. I could look at increasing the seeding rate of my crop and building a crop canopy, we call it, or, you know, covering the soil really quickly so the weeds don't get light and access to grow, but that we make that crop more competitive.
So wait, how does that work then? So how do you till and kill the weeds without also turning over your crop? And then how do you get the crop to come up faster than the weeds?
So everything is sort of in sequence. So we have to think about the timing. So the tillage would happen prior to planting.
Okay.
And cleaning whatever weeds might be there. Then you would plant your crop and plant it, you know, at the best time for it to emerge quickly out of the soil and grow. And if you've knocked the weeds down and then plant the crop, you're getting that crop ahead of the game.
Okay. And then what else goes into this integrated management?
So then we also think about the crop rotation. So it's not just planting soybeans every year, but that we change the crop, because that throws the weeds off. Usually you get the same kind of life cycle. So Palmer is a summer annual weed, loves summer annual crops like corn and soybean. Well, if I change to wheat, winter wheat, which is planted in the fall and grows through to the next year, that's a different time of year for that plant to grow, and there's something growing there that the pigweed doesn't like. Mm-hmm. And so if we change the life cycle and the timing of these different crops and crop rotation, we're always keeping the weeds on their guard and not allowing them to do well. So crop rotation is important.
So, but why would that? So in that, so if you plant in the winter, then for winter mm-hmm. wheat, but the pigweed likes the summer. So does that mean that the pigweed just kind of like that the resistant super weeds will die out and won't be able to come back when you switch back to summer planting?
The weed seeds will still be there, but we tend to use other practices in producing the crop when we're doing it at this different time that does injure those weeds.
Okay.
So we're doing different practices that doesn't help the Palmer amaranth or other summer annuals that might be a problem in those summer crops.
Okay. Anything else that would be part of this? I mean, you're still using the herbicide, but just like changing up the kind of herbicide you're using?
So there's timing of herbicide applications, again, to the soil and to post, and just finding multiple different products. We don't want to go with just one because if you miss the weed, it'll survive. So we're looking at mixtures and multiple products that we need to mix at the appropriate levels, and so then we don't let one escape or don't let a few escape.
Okay. So it's really about variety rather than just being so heavily reliant on large amounts of herbicide spray.
Correct.
And also, does it mean moving away from using the genetically modified Roundup Ready seeds that so many farmers use?
That could be an option, but that still gives us, as a farmer, I'm saying us, but in general terms as growers of these crops, that still gives us some protection to have those traded crops. There's no impact. Trying to think of how to describe it, but basically almost all our soybeans have those traits in there. There's very few that don't. And so it gives us that sort of insurance that if I needed to go in and spray Roundup, it's still very effective on other weeds like grasses. Mm. And so I don't want to lose that tool, but I also need to add other things to the mixture in order to be able to get broad spectrum control.
Professor Dilley, you've described what sounds like a solution to the super weed problem. Are farmers starting to employ that? Like, what would stand in the way of them doing what you described?
There are a number that employ multiple tactics, mainly because we see just incredible impacts of these weeds if we don't control them on the yields, the productivity of what we want. And so that's driving farmers to search for and implement, you know, these alternative practices or multiple practices in order to be able to produce a crop. And to make, you know, a profit out of that.
Is it more expensive to do what you described?
It can be more expensive, but in the long run, you don't want to lose a whole year when you have a weed disaster. And so using multiple tools keeps those populations of the weeds at a low level, less impact, and in the long-term economics, it makes a lot of sense.
A weed disaster. What does a weed disaster look like, and does that happen all that often?
We haven't seen it as much lately, but for certain crops where that was really the only tool, and folks were not. This is where that super weed comes in. All of a sudden, Palmer amaranth. If someone didn't realize and not manage it for a few years, you can have just solid weed stand across a field, and very difficult to find your crop. So you've lost yields. It's very hard to put a machine through there to try to harvest it because you got weeds in growing in there instead of the crop, and there's not much to harvest. And so that's when you get a disaster. So we're really hoping in our teaching and in our outreach programs that we have for many weed scientists across the country, just showing and highlighting, you know, what are these strategies in order to manage these weeds so that we don't get a disaster.
How far away do you think we are from a situation where those would become more common?
The weed disasters?
Yeah.
I think we've run into a few already. There's been stories of just lost soybean and cotton production fields because Palmer amaranth has just taken over. And so we have had farmers that are just desperate. What do we need to do? And so some of those, that takes some thought and planning. And that's really a big part of integrated weed management is doing the planning and thinking of how do I go after this weed ahead of time and not reacting?
Anita Dilley is a professor of weed ecology at the University of Kansas. Thanks a lot for your time today.
Thank you.
This is Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. Coming up next, if your kid decides not to go to college, what kind of career options can still offer financial security and quality of life? I'm Julie Rose. Good to have you with us today for Top of Mind. Most families I know have at least one kid in the mix for whom college doesn't quite seem like the right fit. And if you are a college-educated parent yourself, that can be a troubling prospect, if not downright terrifying. No parent wants to see their kids stuck in a cycle of minimum wage jobs, unable to access the higher earning potential a college degree can unlock. Ken Rusk has a message for those parents and kids. He's a construction entrepreneur and author of Blue Collar Cash, which makes the case for embracing careers that don't require a college degree. Rusk himself started out digging ditches as a teenager, and he did not graduate from college. He's on the line to talk a bit about his own path and about his new book. Hi there, Mr. Rusk. Welcome.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
So what's your first piece of advice for a panicked college-educated parent of a child who's just not feeling the college thing?
Well, first off, we just need to take a step back and look at some kind of reality within our populace as it is today. So at any one time, there's about 167 million workers in the United States. And about 70 million of those people do something with their hands. So it wouldn't make a whole lot of sense for us to push all 167 of our future kids into college, because then who would be around to do those kinds of things, like build roads or houses or whatever you might do in the trades, electrical, plumbing, heating, air conditioning, any of those types of things. So that's kind of my first step. The other thing is, what we really need to understand is it has always been a lucrative place to be in the trades. Sometime around the late 80s, when we took shop class out of high school and replaced it with computers, we kind of switched our mentality to this whole college prep high school thing. And that really eliminated millions of kids from accidentally discovering those types of trades, welding and carpentry and electricians and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, it's a situation where we need to take a step back and we need to understand that it was lucrative before, but now with the supply and demand problem that we have, it is really lucrative to be in the trades today.
Right. Anybody who's paid a plumber or a contractor or an electrician knows that it can be lucrative. So you're specifically then talking about trade jobs. You're not recommending that people skip college and work in retail and hope to sort of make it out of the minimum wage cycle.
Well, yeah, you know, one of the challenges that I have, and I've got 200 employees now. We started with six, so you know, we've done a lot of hiring over the years, and one of my challenges is we seem to position people to say, well, if you go to high school and if you get good grades and if you get a scholarship or if you go to college and if you get a degree, then if you get a job, you'll start to live the life that you want. I think that's exactly the opposite of how we need to teach our young people. I think we need to say, what do you see your life looking like? What's the level of life that you would make you happy? What's your nirvana? What is your comfort, peace, and freedom, as we talk about in the book? And then let's figure out all the different options available to get them the life that they see. So, you know, I've always believed that if you don't necessarily know where you're going, then why would you go to college and rack up all that debt? Now, I need to tell you, I'm not an anti-college guy at all, okay? If you're going to operate on my shoulder so I can get back on the golf course, or if you're going to engineer a building or teach people or manage money or something like that, yeah, you have to know everything there is to know. But if you're just going to school because society says that you should to get away from the stigma of a blue-collar career, that's not a real good reason to spend all that money and come out the other side with no real prospects.
How much do you think the stigma affects the choices that you see young people making?
Well, I have to tell you, I was at a party the other day, and you know, it's that time of year where people are thinking about going back to school or what have you. And, you know, it's always humorous because you have the parents standing in a circle and it's like, well, my daughter's going to this college and my son's going to that college. And then it gets around to eventually one of them says, well, what's happening with so-and-so's son? Oh, he's just going to be a plumber. Well, I always laugh because I know that kid and I know what he's done. And now he's got a half a dozen vans and 12 employees and he's making an absolute killing, but he's just a plumber. So I think one of the biggest misnomers or the biggest misinformation campaigns we've run in the last 20, 30 years is that if you don't go to college, you can't make any money. And believe me, even from my own experience, that's absolutely ridiculous. Nothing could be further from the truth.
You did go to college initially yourself, right? Tell us what happened, why you ended up not finishing.
I kind of went kicking and screaming. I mean, I had four brothers and I was number four on the list, and the other ones went and some went and kept it. Some went and dropped out. Some finished the whole time. But I knew that I was one of those kids who loved to work outside. I loved to work with my hands, but more importantly than that, I loved to control my own input level and therefore my output quality or the product that I created. And also the financial rewards for doing both of those things. So I lasted about 6 months in college because I knew the whole time I was in there, this just wasn't for me. And believe me, I think kids are smart enough to recognize that, you know what, this isn't necessarily my path. I would rather go build a house than go to a business school and perhaps get really good at beer pong, but that's about it coming out the other side. Mm-hmm. So it was just a choice for me that was pretty obvious.
And did you know that because at that point you had been working in construction, right? You'd been digging ditches, like you had your toe in that world. Did you see what the future of that was for you? Like it was, I'm going to quit college and figure out how to open my own business. I want to be an entrepreneur. That's where the money is.
Well, first off, I think two things. Number one, you know, in the book, we write about the nine qualities of an entrepreneur. And I have to tell you, I think that everybody has these nine qualities inside them already. They might be just the thing that's in the back of your closet that you haven't worn in a while. But once you start to visualize what you want your life to look like, and I did a really good job of that early on. I just knew what I wanted. I knew what I wanted to live like. I knew what I wanted to drive, where I wanted to live, the type of place I wanted to be. Once you have a pretty good clarity of what you want your life to look like, you know, to me, it was like, okay, I'm going to work within this organization, work really hard. And I can tell you in this day and age, if you're willing to look at someone in the eye and give them a nice bright smile and a firm handshake and God forbid show up on time, you're going to rise to the top really quickly. And that's kind of what happened to me.
Why didn't digging ditches turn you off of blue collar work? I mean, I know plenty of people who and parents who are like, sure, you don't think you want to college? Want to go to college? All right. Why don't you go, you know, work on a construction crew for a summer in the heat and that'll teach you, you know, where I worked in food service for a summer before college. And I was like, yep, I made the right choice. I'm glad I'm going to college because this is not for me. Why didn't you think digging ditches turned you off of it?
I look at it this way. If you can convince somebody that they are really in control of their life, then that opens up a whole range of options that they might not have seen before. For me, I knew that I could dig ditches so that I could fill my gas tank. I could take my girlfriend out for pizza. I could go to the movies and buy a new pair of jeans. So I knew that I could do those things with and through this effort. But I also knew that there was all kinds of other options out there, like carpentry and plumbing and welding and baking and cooking, electricians, whatever it might be. And what's exacerbated that even more is right now you've got a situation where kids aren't growing up, you know, playing around in the backyard, building tree forts with hammer nails and lumber. They're building these things on Minecraft on their cell phones. And that's not the same experience. So I think what happens is if you don't get to experience the possibility of that, and the options that are out there for you, you're really missing out on an amazing opportunity, especially in this today's current environment.
So let's look at this from the perspective then of a parent who's college educated. So that's the path that they know and the path that they envisioned for their child. But they've got this child, you know, a teenager, a young adult who college is not for that kid. What can the parents do to help that kid make sure that the path that they choose doesn't end up getting them stuck in what many Americans experience, which is a cycle of low skilled minimum wage work?
Well, first off, if it's your goal to get out of high school and just work in a low end retail job or a low end fast food job, that's never been the type of goals that I'm talking about. I'm talking about someone who says, I'd like to create things, build things, improve things, maintain things, those types of things. So when I look at it that way, I think to myself, okay, I have all these options available to me. I'm being told I only have this one path I need to take. And as a parent, you know, here's some quick math, okay? Let's assume you have someone that isn't meant for college and they go anyway, and there's, you know, they rack up $40,000 a year in debt, which could be $160,000 before they're done, right?
Yeah.
So now let's compare that to someone who goes right into carpentry or plumbing or welding or electricians. They're actually earning $40,000 to $50,000 and more per year right out of the gate. So now you're talking about $160,000 positive versus $160,000 negative, which is really a $320,000 swing in their net asset base. So that's some pretty serious money if you don't know exactly why you're going to college to take that risk.
Okay, so from the parents' perspective again, you know, they've got this teenager who is gonna get through high school by the skin of their teeth, not really suited to college, but again, wants to be able to live, you know, wants to have the toys, wants to have the comfortable lifestyle, wants to have the house and, you know, a retirement in their future and the ability to support a family. What are some of the things that parents can encourage that young person to explore to make sure that they can get on a path or find that thing? Where can they go if they're not going to go to college to figure out what their life might hold? What can they do instead?
Actually, a couple things. Number one, there's two or three different apps and websites that are out there talking about exactly what jobs are being hired where and for what dollars per hour. And when you start to look at these trades jobs, you know, earning $35, $40, $50 an hour, you can add that up real quick and see what type of life that could create for you. So, you know, that's the first thing. The second thing is, because of the extreme demand on workers, you can literally job shop six ways from Sunday, much more than you could ever do in the past. So you could literally say, I'm going to go work as a carpenter's assistant and see what that's like. Then I'm going to go work as a plumber's assistant, see what that's like, or an electrician's assistant and see what those jobs are like, and just kind of explore like you would anything else. I mean, we spend so much time looking for colleges and visiting colleges and all these other things. If you took some time, maybe took a summer off and just went around and looked at some of these things that are available in your area, you're going to find some pretty amazing dollars per hour and financial rewards for doing a job like that.
So what's the conversation that you think parents of any you know, young adult graduating high school, what's the conversation they should be having right now?
It's probably pretty similar to what I do with my employees. When I hire somebody new, I will get out a large poster board. And believe it or not, I'll get out a box of 64 old-fashioned Crayola crayons. And I will say, let's talk about what you want your life to look like. In other words, why are you here? You know, beyond I need a job, beyond I need to get paid, beyond I need to pay my bills. Let's talk about what you see for yourself in the future. And I think when that starts to happen, all these conversations start to happen that you may not have had before, because again, we shove them through this if-then society rather than starting with the then and figuring out how to get there. So yeah, I would sit him or her down and say, what do you see for yourself in your life? You know, what kind of expenses is all that going to take to make your life the way you want it? And then do any of these jobs fulfill that level or that need? And believe me when I tell you, they do.
And you are an example of a blue collar career where it became especially lucrative once you became an entrepreneur, right? Starting your own business and investing in other businesses. Is that the primary way that a blue collar career becomes a $1 million life through business ownership?
I can tell you this, to start off, there are many jobs that are paying six figures in a very short period of time within your first 3 or 4 years in the trades. So 10 years of that is your $1 million minus your expenses, obviously. But so that's a beginning. The other thing is, what most people don't recognize is when you're a young person and you get into like a 401k situation, you can save $60 a week for 10 years and stop saving and retire with $1.2 million in your account. So I don't think most people know that, which is why we teach people here, forget about your first $60. You never saw it. You never earned it. It's not yours. It's going right to an investment type scenario. But yeah, I mean, it's no secret. I did really, really well just with the main company that my quote unquote ditch digging company. I did really well and continue to do well with that. But it also gives you the freedom to think about investing in some other things and then kind of parlaying that effort. And again, I truly believe that each one of us has this entrepreneurial spirit within us, as long as we're driven by something that we see that we want for ourselves in our lifetime.
Is there any aspect of your career path that would have been easier if you had had a college degree?
No, I don't think so. I mean,
In terms of getting investors, getting the bank to take you seriously, opening doors, understanding how to run a business.
It's funny. I honestly have to say no. I would tell you this. There are probably a few times when I sat around with bankers or lawyers or accountants and, you know, I had to have them explain that to me a few more times than maybe somebody else. But I have to tell you, nobody that comes into my world or any of my friends' worlds and sees what we've accomplished, nobody says first thing out of the gate, hey, where'd you go to school? You know, their first thing is, how did you grind this life out? How did you make this happen for yourself? And we're happy to share that information. But I mean, I do see your point about, yeah, is there something that maybe planning or learning how to run a company might be easier if you've gone to college. But I also tell you this, even when I was in college, you had to do payroll with a pencil and a piece of graph paper. That's how you did your accounts payable, accounts receivable. You used an adding machine. Well, now you can run a whole business on your cell phone and with a pickup truck. It's never been easier to do something like that, because all that background work has been done for you, and it's a simple one app, a button touch away. You know,
is it harder work to get to that level in a blue collar avenue compared to getting the college degree that opens so many doors?
Well, again, I would just push back a little and say when you say open so many doors, that there is. Right now, there is an amazing oversupply of generic business degree graduates in this country that can't find jobs paying $50,000 a year. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was the average starting salary for the last 2 years with a 4-year college degree. I look at it as, take a look at one of these other options and, you know, see if you can't build the life you want for yourself and be happier doing it. I talked to a plumber today, who's 52 years old. He was in sales. He went to college. He did the whole corporate software sales thing. And he goes, I was a plumber when I was a teenager, and I quit my job to go back to plumbing because I knew I would be so much happier. I'm not sitting in some cubicle on the 15th floor of some building where I'm just a small cog in a huge machine. When you're doing your own thing, you get to see the beginning, the middle, and the end, and that step back moment is entirely yours.
Ken Rusk is a construction entrepreneur in Ohio and author of Blue Collar Cash. Love your work, secure your future, and find happiness for life. Thanks a lot for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Yes, thank you. Thanks for having me.
And that's it for our show today. It's been great having you with us. Top of Mind is a production of BYU Radio. Ciara Hewlett, Cleon Wall, and Kyle Raymond produced the show. We'd love to connect with you on social media. You can find us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at BYU Top of Mind. And you can email us if you'd like to get in touch that way, topofmind@byu.edu. We'd love to hear your thoughts. We're online at byuradio.org/topofmind. I'm Julie Rose. We'll talk soon.